You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I want to take the opportunity to welcome in a special way our two panelists this morning, Sujan Awaz, whose book we are going to discuss, and Pauline Nayak, who has been a friend of mine now for at least 20 years and has suffered me for the last 20 years. So thank you, Pauline. Thank you, Sujan, for coming here. I said the subject of the book is particularly timely because although it is a book that ostensibly is about the Pakistan Army, in many ways it's an analysis of Pakistan itself. And it does a remarkable job of untangling the complex relationship between the Pakistani state and the most important institutional manifestation of that state, which is the army. It is a book that I would very strongly commend for you to read. I'm halfway through the book myself, and I have been reading it for the last 3 days. And I must tell you that it's a book that is hard to put down because it is not, and thankfully so, a dry academic history. There is a place for academic histories, and I'm not opposed to academic histories. But this is a book that is extremely even-handed and balanced in its treatment of what is a very complex reality. Because the Pakistan Army as an institution stirs up very strong emotions, not only in Pakistan, but also in the United States. And therefore, to do justice to a subject that is controversial in this sense of the word, and to do it in a way that is fair to the personalities and the institutions involved is truly an achievement. There is another element of the book that I think makes for compelling reading, and that this is not a detached history. Suja, as those of you who have had a chance to read his biographical statement will know, was born into a military family, spent his whole life in some proximity to the Pakistan Army, and is the brother of a former Pakistani Army Chief of Staff. For at least that reason, besides his own scholarship and his own reputation, he had incredible access to documents in General Headquarters and to a whole range of personalities whom he interviewed. And so what you have in the book is a certain mark of authenticity that comes from knowing the institution that is the subject of the analysis. And so in some sense, this is really an insider's book. But to Suja's credit, it is really an insider's book that is also critical. And this, I think, is really a remarkable accomplishment. Because despite the temptations for someone in his position to paper over problems caused by the Pakistan Army, either deliberately or inadvertently in its country's life, Suja has not succumbed to the temptation of giving this institution a pass. When you read the book, and I've read, as I said, half of it, you cannot escape the sense that what he is describing is ultimately tragic, in the classic Greek sense of the word tragic. That is, you have an institution that has a very storied beginning, very noble intentions, but because of circumstances, hubris, fate, and the actions of the gods, all the things that Greek tragedy talked about, ends up becoming fundamentally part of the problem that Pakistan faces today. And so you have this terrible dilemma that on one hand, the Pakistan Army still remains the best manned, the most coherent institution within Pakistan, but perhaps an institution that is far stronger than that country requires in some sense. And to kind of untangle this tension is really what the substance of the book is about. And so without really any qualification, I would commend the book to your attention and urge you to read it. And I hope it receives wide attention in the United States and in South Asia, not only among academics and people in the policy world, but particularly among policymakers, because embedded in the book are some painful truths about the United States' own past involvement with Pakistan. And Suja, I think, does a fine job of not giving us a pass on that subject either. So this is really, in many ways, what the core of the book is about. I know you all didn't come here this morning to hear me on the subject. So without further ado, I want to pass the baton on to Suja, who will speak about the substance of the book and relate it to the current evolution of developments in Pakistan. And I've asked him to speak particularly on what the current shape of the Pakistan Army and its disposition implies, particularly for success in the war against terrorism, the future of Pakistan's evolution as a state, and the complex negotiation that is taking place between the civilian and the military arms within Pakistan. After Suja speaks, I will call upon Pauline Nayak to offer brief comments on some of these themes that I've just highlighted. I want to say a few words just by way of biographical detail before I surrender the floor. I said something briefly about Suja. I would urge both of you to, of course, look at the biographical statements. Suja has had a long career in public affairs. He worked for Pakistan Television and actually covered the 1971 war between India and Pakistan, and then had a stint at the World Bank and edited for many years the journal Finance and Development. So he comes from an intellectual tradition that is actually quite familiar with economic issues. And because of his own background and the familial relations and the connections back home in Pakistan, he's had this relationship with the Pakistan Army as a detached insider, which is what is reflected in the book. Polly comes from an entirely different tradition. She has been in the intelligence community with the U.S. government throughout her career, and actually retired a few years ago at really the peak of her profession. For many years, she was responsible for actually drafting the presidential daily brief. I'm not sure whether that's in a bio, and I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to say it, but that's where it was. And she extensively briefed six series of presidents on issues relating to South Asia. And for many of the years that are the subject of the book, particularly the 80s and the 90s, which were very crucial times, Polly really had a ringside view of U.S. government policymaking with respect to Pakistan. So without further ado, let me thank all of you for coming this morning, and I'm going to surrender the floor to Suja. Thank you, Suja.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you, Ashley. Given your extremely generous words, I think probably the best thing would be to stop right here. But since so many people have shown up, and so many people who know Pakistan and who know the area very well, I feel I must fulfill my obligation. I'm very grateful for your comments. Yes, it was hard to maintain a certain detachment. My friend Tariq Ali, in his review in the London Review of Books, said that I was too dispassionate, because Tariq, as most of you who know him, is one who always shows his passion with great fervor. I'm not going to try and give you a summary of the book. It's very hard to summarize something that approaches almost 700 pages. But what I will do is, following Ashley's instructions, set the army in the context of Pakistan's history and the relationship between the civil and the military, and particularly bring it up to date to see what's happening now and what's what the relevance of the Pakistan Army is. I will not get into all the issues that I probably would want to cover in great depth, for instance, nuclear proliferation or the ISI or the war of 1971 and the military action in East Pakistan, later Bangladesh. But I'm sure that those will come up, as they often do, in the exchange after the presentations, and I'd be quite happy to speak on those. I just want to start off by saying that over the years, and now it's been 61 years since Pakistan came into being, the Pakistan Army has been regarded with some merit as being a highly disciplined and a well-trained force, which has fulfilled the basic mission that was given to it, and that was to defend the external borders of Pakistan, particularly against what was seen as a very large and hostile neighbor, which was India. And except for the 1971 episode in which half the country was lost, not through any lack on the part of the army, but because of poor strategic thinking and leadership, which has been the constant theme of Pakistan Army history and the nation's history. The army still continues to attract a lot of people. It's a volunteer army. It has recently been reduced from about 550,000 regular forces to about 484. So this is a voluntary reduction. And yet, when you look at the recruitment, it's fascinating that roughly 10 times the number of people required for each course at the Pakistan Military Academy actually apply to get in. So it's a bit like Harvard or Princeton or Yale or the better schools in this country, that it really doesn't have to strive to attract young men for whatever reason. And we look at some of those later on. Now, the latest period of military rule, and this is one of a series of military rules in the country which account for more than half the life of the country. The latest rule under President Pervez Musharraf, or General Pervez Musharraf, has left the army harmed immensely. It has also harmed the polity of Pakistan, and that's because you can't detach the two. As Ashley was saying, it's very hard to separate the history of Pakistan from the history of the Pakistan Army. Now, what's happening today is that we have a new army chief, General Ashfaq Pervez Kiani, who took over last November. And he is trying, in his own words, to take the army back to its professional roots. But he faces a very difficult job. He began off on the right foot, as he explained to me recently. I had a chance to have a long session with him because the elections were due in December. And, of course, as all of us know, they were postponed to February 18th because of the assassination of Prime Minister Bhutto. But in the elections, he made it very clear publicly to all and sundry that the Pakistan Army was not going to be involved in holding the elections. It would not run the elections. The army would only provide the environment, the secure environment in which the elections could take place. By doing so, and by taking ostensibly a neutral stance, he affected the elections. And the main reason the army affected the elections was that it had a presence at the polling booths and in the districts, particularly in the key districts where trouble was expected. And as a result of the army's presence, there was no trouble. And there was also a reluctance to get into blatant rigging in those key districts where the army had a strong presence. So as many people say, this was, relatively speaking, reasonably free and fair elections. He also turned inward because in the period that General Musharraf was in power from 1999 till his recent resignation, he essentially was a half-time chief of army staff, or even less than half-time, because gradually he lost touch with the army, and he lost touch with the rank and file of the army. Kiani turned inward. He designated 2008 as the year of the soldier, and he immediately started visiting the troops. Even as the vice chief, which was his appointment prior to being made the chief by Musharraf, he first of all went to Fatah, the federally administered tribal area. And this was remarkable that this was the area where the Pakistan forces were fighting a life and death struggle against the militants, and Musharraf had never set foot in Fatah. And so Kiani went there, and he immediately tried to assess the situation for himself, talk to the troops, talk to the officers, and then made certain decisions. during his conversation with me recently, he kept repeating that I want to take the army back to its professional roots. And I kept thinking, well, you may not be able to keep yourself away from politics because many an army chief has made that pledge and has had to go back on it as the country implodes around him. Now, there may be good reasons for him to go back to the professional roots. First of all, the army had come into great disrepute under Musharraf. It had fallen from public grace. Some of the public opinion polls conducted by the International Republican Institute, for instance, showed quite clearly that over the last 2 or 3 years, the army, which ranked number one as the most popular and respected institution in the country, with a popularity rating of 90-plus percentage points, had fallen to number three. And it had fallen behind the news media and the judiciary. And this was something of a shock to the army, among other things. That, plus the terrible showing of the Frontier Corps in the federally administered tribal area, really highlighted the poor training and the ill capacity of the military in fighting an insurgency. Now, we should know and understand that the Frontier Corps is not the regular army. It's a paramilitary force, and it is recruited from the local area, so there were many good reasons why many of them were reluctant to fight their own fellow tribesmen. But in the public mind, it's very easy to conflate the two, and so when the Frontier Corps started surrendering in large numbers or lost many battles against a very well-equipped and well-trained Taliban, this was suddenly seen as the Pakistan Army not doing as well as it should. And to some extent, the blame was right, because the Frontier Corps does have officers from the regular Pakistan Army, and over the years there had been a gradual decrease in the quality of officers sent to the Frontier Corps, and for that the Army must take responsibility. That is now being reversed. Now, where do we stand today? Politically, we have a civilian government that's finding it very difficult to find its feet, to establish its control after a prolonged military rule. And this is not surprising, and it's not entirely the fault of the political government. This is just part of our history, and we keep repeating it. And if history is any guide, any successor to an autocratic or a dictatorial regime in Pakistan invariably ends up wearing all the garb of the previous regime, even though it calls itself a civilian government. So it ends up retaining all the dictatorial powers and all the autocratic powers of the previous regime. And then as a result of that, the people get upset, and when the time comes, they come out onto the streets or they vote the government out. The current government has also made some mistakes already, and it has made its mistakes because it appears that we don't read our own history. And I'll cite you one example. There was a notification issued while I was in Pakistan to put the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency under the advisor to the Ministry of Interior, who is de facto the Minister of Interior. Now, the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency is predominantly a military institution. It has one part of one of its six wings that deals with political internal matters with a view to looking at counterterrorism within the country. And that is the wing that was of interest, obviously, to the civilian government. But they issued a notification, and it appears that the notification had not been discussed in detail and explicitly agreed to with the army chief. And so there was an instant reaction, and the notification had to be withdrawn. For those of us who lived through Pakistan during the Benazir Bhutto regime, and those of us who'd read or written about that period, we know that a similar attempt was made by Ms. Bhutto. When she arrived as the Prime Minister, she was very young and inexperienced, and her advisors told her that she could now appoint people that she wanted in the senior military slots. And so a notification was issued in 1989 to replace the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Sirohi. He had been the naval chief before. She was told that once you're a chief, you only have 3 years service, and his 3 years were coming up, and so therefore he could be sent home. What she didn't know that the rules allowed him to get another 3 years once he got promoted to the chairman's slot. And so the admiral went to President Ghulam Ishaq Khan. Ishaq said to him, sit tight, they can't do anything to you. And that's exactly what happened. So from that point on, there was a complete rift between the army chief, General Begg, and Prime Minister Bhutto, which she acknowledges in her interview with me that I've cited in the book. The other mistake that this government has made, or may be making even now, is trying to reach some kind of accommodation with the Islamic parties that would give them time to regroup and to maintain their strength, particularly in the Northwest frontier. If you recall, President Musharraf did exactly the same. In order to get himself elected as president and to be allowed to concurrently hold the office of Chief of Army Staff, General Musharraf agreed with the Islamic parties to give them space to operate, and they indeed formed a government in the Northwest Frontier Province. And they achieved such a huge entry into the National Assembly that that continued to dominate Pakistani politics during his period. And it was during that period that you had the roots of the Islamic militancy grow in the Northwest Frontier Province. Before that, there was none. The danger now is that if today the military operations, which have allegedly or reportedly been halted because of Ramadan, if that continues at a time when the military clearly seems to be gaining momentum in its fight against the militants in the settled area of Swat and Malakand and Bajor and Dir and in the other federally administered tribal areas, you will find that the Taliban of Pakistan and the Afghan Taliban and the jihadi Sunni militants from Punjab that are now their partners will find this a great opportunity to regroup and to prepare themselves to attack the army as soon as Ramadan is over, if not before. The other big issue is that you have an army that as a whole is not trained for fighting a low-intensity conflict. Now, my reckoning is that it's been quite a while since the army as an institution has understood that it's not going to be fighting any large-scale conventional war, particularly against India, and particularly in order to win Kashmir by military force. We've already fought a number of wars. Both sides know each other's minds like the back of their hands. They know what moves are going to be made, and the quantum of force is just not there to allow anything like this to happen. Even Kargil, which many think was a mistake, was essentially a tactical exercise. It was not a strategic move, although General Musharraf still mistakenly believes that it was a great strategic move. So the army is really now gearing up for what essentially means a revolutionary change in its approach and structure. It needs to be looking at how it's going to fight the wars within, and particularly the one that's now keeping it busy on the western frontier and in the northwest frontier province. And that is now entering the hinterland as evidenced by the attacks on the army itself in Rawalpindi, in Islamabad, in Sargodha, in Karia, and so many other places. And so it needs to take a very careful look at what kind of training is required, what kind of equipment is required, and how long and how quickly it will need to regroup and to refocus its attention. It's also under increasing pressure from the United States because of its involvement with Afghanistan. In my recent trip, particularly to Fatah and to the Northwest Frontier Province, in talking to the military officers at all ranks, the one thing I kept hearing was that the U.S. wants us to do more. But in fact, they want us to do all because the U.S. doesn't have a commensurate strength in Afghanistan. And it was mentioned, for instance, that Pakistan has 1,000 outposts all along the border to try and prevent the Taliban from entering and exiting Pakistani territory. And it's an impossible task. And the United States, NATO, ISAF, and ANA has a total of something like 80-plus posts. So they see a huge disconnect between what is required and what is requested of Pakistan and what is being done on the other side. And that's a perception that I think one needs to keep in mind. You also have to recognize that the army is basically dealing with the effects of history, because General Ziaul-Haq, during his period, essentially gave the western frontier, and particularly Fatah, to the mullahs. He put them on the dole. He used zakat funds to finance the mullahs. The madrasas had already been set up during the war against the Soviets, and he continued to provide financing for them in the frontier as well as in the rest of the country. And his Islamization essentially allowed the mullah to become the political leader in Fatah and in the frontier. The Political Parties Act doesn't apply to Fatah, so they are not allowed to campaign there, although during my visit and before, people tell me that the parties are active in the sense that they use surrogates. And I saw a lot of party flags flying on the houses when I was in Miranshah, for example. So they're not allowed to act openly, so they cannot really challenge the mullah in a regular way. Moreover, during General Musharraf's period, we had a number of attempts where the military went in, particularly when General Aurakzai was corps commander in Peshawar. He later became the governor. He went in. He basically ignored the Maliks, and he ignored the political agents that were the traditional people acting on behalf of the government in Fatah, and went and tried to attack the militants, and with no local support, essentially, it was not a very successful operation. But what it did do was it eliminated the power of the Maliks and the powers of the political agents, which, though they are anachronistic, were still somewhat useful in helping maintain order in what is essentially a tribal society. But what is happening now is that you've got a move away from the tribal society, and you have essentially a regional movement, the Tehreek-e-Taliban of Pakistan, which is not bound by tribal boundaries nor tribal rules any longer. And it has made franchise arrangements with the militants in Swat and franchise arrangements with the militants in Jhang and southern and central Punjab, who are now helping them in the fight, not only against the state, but also in the Parachinar area against the Shia minority. Now, why has this situation come to pass? First of all, and my book tries to chart this in the history of Pakistan and the history of the Pakistan Army, there has been a national failure in producing a polity that recognizes the aspirations of the people of Pakistan. We have a top-down structure in politics, and it's a highly personalized leadership in all the political parties that thwarts the democratic impulse. While researching my book, I came across a very interesting study that had been done at the National Defense College in Pakistan by a then brigadier who later ended up in the leadership team of General Musharraf after his coup d'etat in 1999. And let me just quote this paragraph, because it would appear as if it was written today. He says, "Pakistan's political history has been considered as being unmistakably stamped with rank authoritarianism. Throughout the political history of Pakistan, our policy has remained unchanged in terms of families, organizations, and interests. Political figures have changed, but the interests, origins, and behaviors have been the same and personal. Class interests have always taken precedence over the national interest. To remedy all these, we have to ensure that the present democratic system," and this he was referring to Benazir's first stint in office, "must be allowed to function without interruption. The nation must achieve their political objectives through this process of democracy. Otherwise, our problems will further compound by increased dissension, fragmentation among provinces, political agitations, violence, emergence of centrifugal forces, and secessionist tendencies, lack of economic progress, and decline and erosion of the national will." And he puts "will" in caps, which is a standard office procedure for the military. When they want to emphasize something, they always put in caps. And then he didn't confine this just to the civilian system. He went on to look at the military leadership. and which was also described in another paper that I saw as being inept and weak. And that particular author said, we have with no vision and perspective of the future and thus live on a day-to-day basis. But the officer that I was quoting criticized the leadership for lacking creativity and being bound to standard operating procedures, sycophancy, conformity, and careerism. And the latter he held responsible for three major weaknesses of the military leadership in Pakistan. Number one, centralization of command, which is alien to maneuver warfare and curbs initiative. For those of us who don't follow military lingo, it essentially means that when you do not devolve power onto the operational commanders in the field and try and control everyone from general headquarters, you don't give people the room to maneuver, to take initiatives at the local level which will achieve military success. Number two, lack of delegation or authority, similar to centralization. And number three, zero risk syndrome, which creates a risk-averse culture. Now, this was written in 1989, and I think a lot of this criticism remains true, particularly in the aftermath of the Musharraf period. The other issue that we have to understand is that the army traditionally was fairly homogenous. It was primarily a rural recruited army. Even the officer class had very rural ties, primarily came from a very limited part of the country, the northern Punjab, the three districts, particularly of what was known as Kembalpur, now Attock, Rawalpindi, and Jhelum, the district I come from. People just went into the army. That was the only thing you did. And that particular system made the army really very homogenous. You had, moreover, a Punjabi-dominated army in the sense that because the Punjab had the largest population, the proportion of Punjabis in the army was huge. Over time, this has changed, and it has changed, first of all, in the recruitment of the soldiers, which is now, for the Punjab, dropped from something like 60-plus percent to 43%. But for the officers, it's dropped only marginally. However, there's been a qualitative change in the structure of the army in that sense, because now the recruitment of the officers is not from the northern Punjab districts, but more from the more highly conservative central and southern Punjab districts. And it's also primarily urban. So you have very few people with predominantly rural roots coming into the army now. And among the urban population, it is the petty bourgeoisie, which has traditionally been very conservative and very religiously oriented. Not to say that they are radicals, but the whole country is shifting towards the conservative end of the religion spectrum, and so within the army, it now reflects that. The most glaring statistic that I found was the recruitment in the decade ending 2005, when you had more officers recruited from Karachi than from Jhelum, and that was striking. The other thing that I saw in the data that I have on recruitment and retirement in the Pakistan Army is that you get a huge bulge in the Zia period from the urban areas. And one reason for that was, as I mentioned in my book, the Jamaat-e-Islami actively encouraged its members to join the army. And so you had this enormous attempt by Zia to introduce an Islamic ethos. So to the extent that even in the annual confidential report of the officers, there was a segment that talked about the religious behavior of the officer in question and what are his views on religion and does he say his prayers regularly and so on, which meant that a lot of people started going to prayers and there was a kind of ritualistic adherence to religion, not that huge a shift otherwise. And I discovered, to my horror, that when my brother was the commandant of the military academy at Kakul, that apparently the Tablighi Jamaat, which is a missionary organization, used to come every Friday to deliver the khutbah at the prayers in the military academy. And on the very first Friday that my brother was there, I happened to be visiting him, and he forbade them from coming again. But I'm sure that that was picked up again after he was moved from Kakul. Another big issue that the army faces is that of its economic footprint. It has a wide economic footprint, which means it has a huge share of the country's budget, well over 40%. And this is seen by many as taking resources away from economic and social development. And all the statistics point to that. When you have an allocation of 3.4% of your GDP to defense, even though it may be for very good reason, it's very difficult to justify when you see that the allocation for the social sector is 1.2% or thereabouts. The Army has also expanded its activities in the commercial area, and this is not just in the military defense industries where a lot of import substitution occurs. And just a footnote about import substitution, this is a means by which a country takes on production of military and military-related equipment so that it doesn't become totally dependent on imports, particularly at a time of war, because Pakistan suffered sanctions after each war, particularly from the United States. It decided that it would try and go for self-sufficiency. But import substitution, like most things in economics that we learn, is very expensive. And so I'll give you one example. I mean, we have a G3 rifle, and I was told by a person associated with the production of that weapon that a washer that is used for the G3 rifle was being produced locally at 28 rupees a washer, and then they discovered that they could import it from Malaysia for about 5 rupees. But they had already set everything up, so they're continuing to produce it in a much more expensive manner. And these things accumulate and become a heavy burden on the exchequer. The commercial activities also have drawn a lot of interest, and there's a recent book by Aisha Siddiqa that mentions a number of these. The military, in the name of providing help to ex-servicemen and to provide subvention for some of its own social welfare activities for the Army, has gone into real estate, insurance, banking, has even gone into construction and so on, and has a very wide range of activities where it is now competing with the private sector and in some cases crowding out the private sector. And this has created a very severe backlash among the civilian population. The other visible manifestation of the military's domination of Pakistani society, particularly during the Musharraf period, was the recruitment and forced induction of military officers into the civil, into the administration, into academia. At one time, nearly all the leading universities' vice chancellors were military officers. Some of them did not have academic credentials at all, except what they'd acquired through their under scrutiny within Pakistan as well as outside Pakistan by friends. One is the role of the ISI. Having examined what has happened in Pakistan involving the ISI, I'm convinced that the ISI is not a rogue agency, that as an agency, it follows what the government of Pakistan does. And over time, the government of Pakistan has used it with an element of deniability because most people were willing to just say, oh, well, the ISI is a rogue agency. The government doesn't know what it's doing. But I've talked to almost all the heads of the ISI in the last few decades, and they all insist that they never did anything that the government did not want them to do. The issue that emerges is that the ISI often follows the ambivalence of the government, and that's what creates the problems, particularly in dealing with some elements of the old Mujahideen factions that are now part of the Taliban. And that's also the reason why you have civilian contractors who are recruited to help maintain liaison with those elements. That is probably the reason why you have these connections being made between the ISI and people like Jalaluddin Haqqani or his son Siraj in Waziristan. The other issue is whether the army itself has now become Islamicized. On that, I will just say that the army is increasingly conservative. Its recruitment and its composition reflects the rest of the country much more than it has done at any point in the past. But I have seen no reason why we would be worried that particularly the leadership of the army would be such that it would take on a radical Islamic tone and take a position that would go against the interests of Pakistan and its allies. Let me stop there, and I'll be glad to take questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Sujat. Can I ask Polly to respond to the few remarks?
Sure. Certainly. Sujat, thank you for a wonderful rundown, which doesn't really begin to milk the richness of your book. And I really also want to join Ashley and many others in congratulating you on a very rich account, made richer by the fact that it is, frankly, personal. You are steeped, by virtue of your own family origins, in the institution on which you write. I want to, before I start commenting further, I want to clarify, speaking of personal, that I am speaking for myself and no other institution, that I in no way represent the U.S. government, for which I have not worked for a number of years. And I need also to confess that I have a deep passion for the subjects which we're discussing as well. My own academic formation on South Asia, I shudder to acknowledge this, began in 1964 and has been continuous since then. So my involvement in South Asian things goes back many years before my government service and includes a period of quite a long period of residence in South Asia, working in South Asia, as well as doing research on South Asia for many, many years. Let me mention what I think is Shuja's unique contribution. There are many legitimate optics, and there have been a number of studies on the Army of Pakistan. And many of these studies have been excellent. And we are, of course, dealing with a situation analogous to the blind men and the elephant. There are as many Pakistan armies as there are people feeling the different parts of the elephant. What this book does that I think is unique is that it is a it brings an element of dispassion, but it is in fact what I would call an inside-out, not an outside-in study of the Army. The Army is the protagonist in this book, and the main focus of the book is on what the leaders of the institution wanted it to be, how the Army tried to remake itself at various times, and how different streams of people in the Army influenced its conduct and its mores. And the other big value added, I think, is a Pakistani Army view, which is critical given the Pakistan Army's role, in the evolution of Pakistan's foreign policy, particularly Pakistani-U.S. relations. And in that, this book is quite different from, for example, Dennis Cook's excellent study of U.S.-Pakistani relations from a U.S. diplomatic vantage point. Thank you. Shuja describes very well how army dominance combined with divided and weak political parties increasingly skewed civil-military relations, so that in the end, as he describes it, in Pakistan, the principal party, political party, is the army. Very important observation. And he also describes, as he's just summarized for you, that one consequence of this is that the army has assumed a somewhat predatory role with respect to the economy with a great sense of entitlement. An observation that he makes right at the beginning of the book, which I think is critical, is that the army is better compared, say, to Indonesia's military than to Turkey's, in spite of the preference of many Pakistani military officers for the Turkish model. And again, he also describes very nicely how the dominance of the army both shaped and was shaped by various wars, as well as relations with and aid from other governments, and of course, in a few cases, internal quarrels. Let me go now briefly to two issues that Shuja has just discussed in his remarks. and has also discussed at far greater length in his book. But these are just two of his many themes. At Ashley's request, Shuja discussed how the Army could deal and what it would need to do so with the new challenge of counterinsurgency, which has not been part, as he explained very clearly, of the Army's traditional problem set. I would pull out two other angles for further discussion, perhaps for your Q&A, perhaps just for Shuja's comment. One of the principal consequences of this new insurgency and the new counterinsurgency challenge to the Army is to the national narrative that forms the basis of Pakistan. Every country has national myths that inform it and that unify it. And as many of us, I think, would agree, the national narrative for Pakistan has included from the beginning the notion that it was surrounded by hostile forces and that the external defense of Pakistan was a core function, a core raison d'etre, and a core rationale for the Army's extraordinary role. And so the question that arises naturally is, well, that being the case, how does this new counterinsurgency role with which the Army is being presented challenge that national narrative that threats come from outside and not from inside? There are, of course, those in Pakistan who say it does come from outside, that this actually is spillover from Afghanistan and has no domestic content. But I would quarrel with that, and I have a feeling that he would as well. So that's one question. How does all of this affect the core national narrative, and which underpins to a great extent not just the military's role, but which has formed a basis for national unity, a rallying cry, if you will. Parenthetically, it's probably worth noting that India, too, is having to redefine its national threats and having to look more inwardly at the sources of some of its current difficulties to acknowledge that a lot of these are now homegrown and there are new elements in play now. The second direction in which I would like to suggest that he go, and he's touched on this already, concerns the Pakistan military's ambivalence about not just the counterinsurgency role, but its counterterrorism role as well. And I think in some ways Shuja touched on part of the answer mentioning that the Army increasingly reflects the Pakistani public, which is becoming a more conservative public. And I would just say that I don't think it's necessary to describe that trend as Islamization at all in order to understand why the Pakistani public does not favor the military's taking on folks in the Fatah, tribals in general, perhaps in part because of the specter of civil war, which again comes back to the question of how unified Pakistan really is now and what the prerequisites are for that unity, the bases, the national myths. So that may be one explanation for the military's ambivalence, but I'm sure that there are others that he would elaborate on. Another angle of the same question is what effect some of these recent setbacks have had on the internal unity of the armed forces. There are, of course, reports in the press about squabbles regarding the relative primacy of the counterinsurgency mission versus the traditional doctrine and defense priority of India as the enemy. So that's probably worth some discussion as well. I would like now just to turn briefly to a second major issue, which he's also touched on in his remarks. In his final chapter, Shuja talks about some of the institutional changes that could help wean the military from its privileged position in the polity and the economy. And a central theme of this book, which I think is perhaps, for my money, the most important, is the troublesome imbalance in civil-military relations between the military and civilians. One element of the challenge to democracy in Pakistan. Now, it's been very clear for those of us who have watched elections in Pakistan come and elections go, and you've made this point very well, Shuja, which is that elections themselves are not sufficient. And you acknowledged, I think absolutely correctly, that frequently the civilian governments that have come in on the heels of the military have actually used the autocratic machinery to their own ends, so that what you've had is civilianization but not democracy. Very important distinction. So if we now take up the question, if we assume that redemocratization would be one process through which civil-military relations could be rebalanced and the public, which you've acknowledged has been largely absent from many of the discussions about power and national goals, could be reintegrated in that discussion. So let me raise a couple of questions. First, it's worth acknowledging that the recent election in February did not take away from the military any of the issues that we started out by discussing. The counterinsurgency and all decisions concerning it, the Pakistan's foreign policy and Pakistan's military priorities, the questions of war and peace internally and externally, are still all in the hands of the military. They have not gone anywhere, regardless of who in the next couple of plays occupies the prime minister's or the president's post. So that raises some difficult questions. If we look somewhat comparatively, as I've done at times through my career, at what would be required to roll back the system and rebalance it. One of the biggest and thorniest problems that arises immediately is who could plausibly mount a challenge to this system from either outside or in, the system as it now exists? Is it possible to sketch a scenario in which this happens, and what are the prerequisites? And that takes us to some extent to the question of, could you get Pakistan's army to support its own obsolescence, in a way, as the principal and dominant institution? In all the cases that I've looked at across the world over time, and I'm certainly by no means an expert on Praetorian democratic shifts, but I have looked at this issue. A key common element has been that the military in question has seen it to be in its own interest to step back, not just for an election or out of the more obvious civilian roles, but more fundamentally, and that, of course, would include to some extent the intelligence services. So there are some very interesting hints in the book from the past of ways, paths that might be adopted by whoever takes this challenge on, perhaps someone in the military. Shuja recounts fascinatingly how in 1972 to early 1973, there was a short-lived plot led by junior officers to replace Bhutto's democracy with something more stable but democratic and not military-led, not further specified. And one of the plotters, as it turns out, was one of your cousins. So one question is there the possibility, are there the intellectual resources within the military to actually have a thought process and a perhaps officially sponsored group that takes a different look with no punishments for coming up with out-of-the-box solutions? That breaks the stranglehold on imagination that you described in the military? Or does it have to come from outside, which seems like an extremely important question. And another theoretical possibility is that a civilian administration, bolstered perhaps by the international community, I don't know, that's for you to comment on perhaps, might be able to circumvent existing security mechanisms. And one thinks back to something you also mentioned, which is how the first Prime Minister, Bhutto, tried by establishing the Federal Security Force, among other institutions, in effect to bypass the existing institutions. And there are some countries that have done that. They have diluted the impact of the existing military institutions by surrounding them with alternatives. So that's another way that Pakistan might go. So it seems to me that this whole question of democratization and the military's own role in it might be a subject for a further study that is invited by what you have done here, which is excellent. I'm disposed to stop here and turn the floor back to you.
Thank you, Polly. Let me suggest an alternative. Why don't we turn the floor open to the audience? And if Suja can address some of these issues in the context of relating to comments and questions. Yes, Jerry.
Yes, Jerry Benny, Park State. I'm just curious as to... I'm curious in what you might have to say about the efforts to train the Frontier Corps in counterinsurgency and re-equip them, which may not have been done as it should so far, but that's the plan to dramatically increase their counterinsurgency capacity. There's some signs that the Pakistan military is not too comfortable with some aspects of that plan as to whether or not it's feasible or it makes sense. And given what you've said about the Frontier Corps and paramilitaries, I was just wondering what you thought of given their role in the Fatah and historically, more or less, I believe, as kind of a police role, whether or not the idea of turning them into some sort of point of the spear on counterinsurgency makes sense or makes sense to the Pakistan military, whether you've heard anything from officers about a change of mission for the Frontier Corps and what they think of it. Thank you.
Certainly. Well, historically, the Frontier Corps, if you go back to the old Waziristan reports, ever since 1901, has had a kind of a mixed result when it came to warfare. They were pretty good in enforcing the peace and, you know, resolving minor disputes on behalf of the political agent. But when it came down to actually fighting, there were numerous accounts that you can see in the Waziristan reports particularly that indicate that they would pack up and go on to the other side. Quite often they were their fellow tribesmen. And so there is always that issue. Now, of course, they are officered by regular Pakistan Army officers, and there has been a change in the view of the Frontier Corps by the Pakistan Army. They've been trying to improve the quality of the officers that they're now sending to this force. Secondly, they've raised the level. So previously, a wing, which was like a sort of regiment of the Frontier Corps, used to be headed by a major, whereas in the regular army, it was a lieutenant colonel. They've now raised it to that of the regular army, so you're now getting better trained officers. All this will take time. The preference of the Pakistan Army that I could gather from visiting with them in the area as well as at headquarters is that the army should not be in Fatah. And the reason for that is quite simple. Ever since 1947, when Mr. Jinnah withdrew the regular army after independence from Fatah, there has been no regular army entering Fatah. So they are seen as an alien force, and many of them regard themselves as an alien force because of the demographics. When you have a 60% Punjabi army, you've got only a 14% representation of the Northwest Frontier Province, not all of whom are Pashto speakers. You have a problem in dealing with the locals, you know, so there is a difficulty there, which is a practical one. At a personal level, I feel, and this has nothing to do with what I heard from the Pakistan Army or elsewhere, I feel that whatever one does with the Frontier Corps should really be only as a transitional mechanism. But if you really want to speed up the process of using the military initially to break the back of the insurgency, you have to be prepared with a tremendous economic and political impetus that must accompany it and must then overwhelm the region. Without that, you're not going to be able to hold it with military force forever and ever. So that's quite critical. And for that, I believe that you need to train, in addition to the FC, and rely more on the regular army. So you need to take elements of the Pakistan army, and there are regiments that are 50% Punjabi, 50% Pathan, that you should inject into the area, train them rapidly in counterinsurgency warfare, and let them bolster the FC. And then there are other suggestions that emerge. For instance, recruiting back the people who take early retirement from the FC and bringing them back into the force to bolster them, because they have the experience, they have the knowledge, and they belong to the area. So there are all these things that you can do militarily, but I think economic and political development you have to be prepared for, and in a big way. No half-hearted measures and no aid which sort of dribbles in, and no paper-bound bureaucracy, because this is a cash economy. They deal in cash, in suitcases of cash, and there'll be leakage whether you have paper or not, but you have to be prepared for that.
Thank you, Sir Douglas.
Yes.
Ravi Khanna from Voice of America. You said that General Kayani is taking the army back to the professional role, and there is still instability on the political front in Pakistan, and it may worsen further down. Do you think he will intervene?
That's the question that everyone asks. I can only rely on history and my experience. Army chiefs, and a number of them, have said that they want to take the army back to barracks and out of politics. But if, and this is a huge wild card, in Pakistan today, the economy, which has been going south in a hurry, deteriorates, and you get into a situation of hyperinflation, for instance, the country may become ungovernable. And you may have civil unrest in not just the border, but throughout the country. With food prices above 32%, food inflation above 32%, and bearing in mind that the poorest people in particular are spending more than half their income on food, that's a huge challenge for any government. So, yes, he says he is determined to take the army back to its professional roots. I think one has to believe him. By the same token, and going back to one of Polly's points, I think there needs to be a national debate and a consensus on what we want Pakistan to be. And that has to involve not just the political parties, but the common man. You need to have an open debate. We have the wherewithal with all the news media now to do that in an open forum. And once you do that, then you can give the army instructions on what you want the army to do. Now, Kayani did go and brief the coalition. He briefed the provincial government also. And for the first time, and this is first in Pakistan's history, you had an army chief who didn't go with a plan. He basically went with a brief. He said, this is the situation. This is what we've done in the past. You need to get together and tell me how you want us to proceed, and we will do what you want. And it took them not the 2 or 3 days that he expected, but 4 weeks to come back to him. And still there's kind of ambivalence, particularly on the provincial government side. So to basically underline Polly's point, till we have a very open and threadbare discussion of what Pakistan is and where we want it to be, you really cannot rely on the military to keep coming back in. And it's just a Band-Aid. It just doesn't work.
My reaction to the comment?
To my question.
Could you repeat your question?
Whether Kayani, in his effort to bring it back to the professional role,
right,
what is he going to do if there's total instability again?
Share responsibility with civilian leaders. I mean, that seems to me to be both a matter of self-interest on the part of the military and perhaps a new opening to bring civilian leaders in, and not just the civilian leaders who have positioned themselves in power, but others as well. I think this really is an opportunity, and you could have an elite discussion. Even that would be a great improvement on what's happened, an intra-elite discussion.
Spurgeon Keeney, the speaker indicated that he was not going to lead off with, but would welcome questions on the Pakistan nuclear weapons situation. I wonder, could he say what he feels the role of the military or the in the control of the nuclear stockpile, and whether there's been any change, will be any change with the change in structure or makeup of the military, and is there any evidence that the military was involved with or familiar with the activities of AQ Khan, the military, and or the intelligence organization?
I'll be glad to try and give you an answer, but I think Simon Henderson is probably the best suited person to answer the last bit of your question, and he's here. This is what I think happened. First of all, in terms of the command and control of the nuclear system, by all accounts, there's been a tremendous change and a development of a structure which even the International Institute of Strategic Studies of London in its last report deemed robust. This was the word they used. So clearly, Pakistan has learned a lot, among others, from the United States in how to manage the system and to manage its nuclear assets. The good news is, if one is to believe what they've done, is that they do not have fully assembled weapons. And so it's not likely that weapons are going to be taken over by anyone who overwhelms one of these facilities. They have to be, they are demated, and so they have to be brought together again before they can function. There is a National Command Authority, and till Musharraf was the president, he was heading it. One of the big fears that has been raised, I know in the media, is about the, for the first time, you will have a civilian president on September the 6th. And what happens then? Does the civilian president take over this command? I say, why not? If we're going to go back to a civilian system, then that's the right role for a civilian president. Of course, there's enough membership of the civil and military in the command authority to ensure checks and balances. On the nuclear proliferation issue, I cannot believe that the military was not aware of some of the things that were going on. I do not know if they were aware of everything that was going on. And the reason for that is quite simple. Based on what I know, because of constant sanctions, Pakistan did not have access to maintenance equipment, spare parts, or new weapon systems. And so they had to rely on whatever sources they could find all over the globe to acquire weapons. They also relied on these sources to get them key weapons from particularly the West, which could then be reverse engineered by Pakistan locally. So, for instance, air-to-air missiles, this is an old story. You know, the sidewinders that the U.S. had provided were just no longer available. And so Pakistan is reported to have reverse-engineered Matras, which they bought on the market. And so, of course, the interest of the military was in shutting up AQ Khan, because if he were to talk, he would be divulging this whole network that the military had used and maybe even still wants to keep in reserve in case it faces sanctions again. So that's about all I can say. Other than when Simon's book comes out or Mr. AQ Khan himself comes out of the country, we really don't know the whole story.
Yeah, my name is Simon Henderson. I won't bother to answer your question because that's impolite to the panel, other than to say please read the book, which I haven't read, but I've read the index and I've read the sections, which are particularly interesting. And he's told a good story, but I don't think it's the real story. And there are gaps in it. I've got a different question, but related to it, which is, in your conversations, both with the military and with the civilian politicians, what do you assess to be the nuclear aspirations of Pakistan, its nuclear policy? I once had a conversation with AQ Khan, and I said, what are you going to do? You're not going to get into an arms race with India, are you? Because history shows that if you get into an arms race with a larger and economically more powerful country, you lose. But it would seem to me that on the basis of what I see now, which is new missiles from China, a whole infrastructure of heavy water plants and reprocessing plants to get the plutonium nuclear explosive from them, that's exactly what Pakistan is doing. Is it trying to match India's existing arsenal? Is it trying to predict what India's arsenal is going to be and wants to match it? What's it trying to do? Because this, for us, is very worrying. We're either going to have a nuclear war or there's going to be a greater chance of a loss of control of at least some of these components.
My feeling is that, like any institution, the Pakistan Army is going to take a lot of time to change its thinking. So there's a tremendous force of inertia at work. You have plans and you have strategies that have been crafted over the past couple of decades that are still on the books. And till you have the possibility of an open debate, even within the military, which didn't take place under Musharraf, and maybe Kiani will allow that now because you have a younger bunch of officers coming to the top, and he will have 10 new three stars between this October and next summer. Till you have that debate, you really can't change the direction of the previous policy. So what, as someone who's studied economics and who knows economics knows, is probably going to be a losing fight in trying to match India's nuclear weaponry will probably continue for the time being. My sense is that they still see this as a kind of a poison pill defense. I really do not believe that the Pakistan Army conceives of using any of its weapons or its forces in some kind of an offensive maneuver to somehow surprise India and take Kashmir. That it continues to have a doctrine of offensive defense so that it will hurt India or whoever tries to invade Pakistan at any point. That's my understanding. But I believe that there will probably need to be an open debate starting with the military and then involve the civil before you have the emergence of a new approach to nuclear weapons and heavy weapons in general.
Christopher Chibitz, RAND Corporation. I wonder if I just might ask you to comment on Polly Nayak's final comment about the state of thinking in the Pakistani army right now. What are the attitudes that you see towards democracy in general and towards Pakistan's democratic future?
The one phrase that I kept hearing from people, and this was not just in my official meetings, but because I know a lot of people in the military and or they know me or my relatives, and it's not just my brother. My whole tribe and family are in the military, and so is my wife. So I have a huge network. Wherever I went, I got a chance to talk to people, and they're fairly open with their comments, almost using the same words, and it's not because that there was some kind of indoctrination occurring within the military, but they all talked of giving the civilian government the time and space to get their act together. And then I think there is a great desire on the part of the military that they really haven't done well being involved in politics, and it's therefore important to let the civilians run things and maybe let them make their mistakes, and that the army is always there to protect the country internally and externally, but that they need to step back. So this was a refrain. Now, of course, it doesn't take very long for the things to change. And the one point that, just responding to something Polly was suggesting, I look at, you know, what to do about changing the military. I have made one very specific suggestion, which is changing the military higher command structure, which would reduce the amount of sort of power, which is in a very steep pyramid in the military, where everything goes to the army chief. And I'm suggesting a broader base for that. That would reduce the ability of the military to act in support of a coup. But much more than that, I think you need a stronger civilian capability in terms of knowledge of the army and the armed services so that you can control the military and involve it in a debate which is an informed debate. Because currently the military view is that the civilians don't know anything and they don't know anything about the army, and you've got to get over that. And the only way you can get over that is by talking to them on their terms, and then they understand that you know what the military is and what its requirements are. And by involving them in that process so that it becomes their idea, I think you can effect that change. But I'm an optimist, and there are lots of pessimists in Pakistan.
Can I abuse the privilege of the chair to just follow up on that question in a more pointed way? Do you have the sense, Suja, that there is a view now in Pakistan that the military at least needs to move towards genuine subordination to the civil? Because I think there's a distinction to be made between we allow the civilian space to rule, but in essence, all we allow them is space to govern. We continue to rule. Versus we allow them space to govern as a prelude to, depending on how successful they are, beginning to become genuine rulers, where the military then subordinates itself to civilian authority. Where are we along that spectrum?
I think we are at a very early stage, and politics is all about power. And as I say in my book, the army is the most powerful political party in Pakistan. You will need one or two very powerful political parties. You will need one or two political parties with transnational support. So it's not just in a province or two provinces. It has to be transnational. And you need a leadership that is not purely based on feudal rights and privileges or family rights and privileges. If you have a strong political leadership and a strong political system, you have a population of 165 million, and if even a quarter of them are active politically and recognize the need for civilian rule, there is absolutely no reason why civilian rule doesn't trump military rule.
Andrew Gray from Reuters, you mentioned General Petraeus in your introduction. As you know, he will take over shortly in Central Command. Do you see him making much difference in terms of the U.S. military's approach and attitude and assistance to the Pakistani military, or does any substantive change have to wait until there's a new administration?
I think the commander, CENTCOM, has a tremendous amount of leeway and resources at his disposal, and he has already been active in conversations with General Kiani, among others, and I know that there are a number of initiatives already underway. Moreover, I think the knowledge that he's acquired in fighting counterinsurgency and militancy in Iraq is going to be listened to, and probably will mean much more to Kiani and his colleagues than anything I or anyone else says. So, a military-to-military conversation often tends to be much more useful. I think also General Petraeus's knowledge of political systems and working with politicians is something that would be valuable, as well as the fact that he has economic resources at his disposal. So when I was talking of a cash economy, I think Petraeus understood that in Iraq. And I think SERPs, you know, this the money that is available for civilian projects, you know, the army in Pakistan has already used up a lot of its own resources in what they call quick impact projects in Fatah and in Swat. I think that kind of stuff can get you traction in isolating the militants, and that's the lesson of counterinsurgency.
Down to the last question, so I'll give it to Marvin.
Thank you, Ashley. Marvin Weinbaum, Middle East Institute. If I can just come back for a second now to the civilian-military relations. Shahjah, traditionally the military has a very disdainful view of the political classes. In your recent, you mentioned these discussions that have been taking place. Are you saying that perhaps they're based on the fact that they have been in power as long as they have, that that changed in any way? Certainly the events since February would make it very difficult for them to, the esteem of the civilian classes to have risen very far. And in this regard, among the current pretenders to the throne in Pakistan, does the military, do you see the military as perhaps favoring one party, one individual over the other, so that there can be some resolution of this kind of tension?
I really didn't see any inclination in favoring one party or the other. Although I must say at the lower levels in particular, now this is the group that was recruited during the Zia period in particular, there wasn't a great deal of sympathy for the People's Party. This was, again, in normal conversations. There's a kind of an institutional memory about the People's Party that tends to go against that, whereas Nawaz Sharif is seen as being a little more pro-military, although some of his actions that led to his departure probably nullified a lot of that, which is why I say that there is really no serious inclination one way or the other. In terms of whether there's been a huge change since February the 18th, I think not. The reason being quite simply that you basically brought back the same people. This is like Groundhog Day. We keep having elections and keep having the same people coming back into power or their sons and relatives. So it will take some time, and this is really where the onus is on the civilians. And I would dispute whether there are many pretenders to the throne. I think there's only one. So, you know, we still have a very imbalanced political system. And I think that imbalance is something that it could be worrisome unless there is a genuine attempt. As Mr. Zardari has said, he wants to create a national government and that they may actually end up inviting Nawaz Sharif back into the cabinet. I think that would be brilliant if it works. I don't think it will.
Well, let me take the opportunity to thank both Suja and Polly in a special way today. Suja for a very, very comprehensive presentation touching on a whole range of issues from domestic politics, the institution of the army, and then, of course, the impact of the army on international relations. And Polly for pushing the discussion further. I suspect we will have reason to have a future event that looks at some of the issues you've raised. Because this is something that has direct impact for the U.S. in policymaking in the year ahead. But let me also thank all of you for coming this morning and for joining us. And if you could give a... Thank you very much.